Hello, let me add my welcome to Andrews. It's great to see lots of new faces. Some of you I've met at the beginning, so please stay around. And we're going to look together at this chapter. And you'll see the little graphic if you're new to us. Neil's designed this, and I really like it. This is a sort of album cover for this series. And I like it because you have to look at it carefully to see what it says. And you sort of puzzle it out, which is kind of the point. When bad things happen to good people. And that's what this series is about. That's what Job's about. Job is a good guy, but really bad things happen to him. Terrible things happen to him. He loses his business, but then more tragically, he loses all of his children. They all die in a single day of a tragedy. And then he loses his health, and then he almost loses his mind. And you might think this is a guy that God's got it in for, but it turns out, no, he's a good guy. And he's a blameless and upright guy. He fears God. He turns from evil. And yet everything in his life's gone wrong. And it makes people ask the question, look, why? What is God up to? Why would this kind of thing happen to somebody like this? And we're wrestling with it. And I guess maybe you've wrestled with it. Maybe you already have, or maybe you will soon. And I want to ask the question, when things go badly for you, when you suffer, or people that you love suffer, and you don't understand, do you blame God for that? And are you angry with God when things have gone wrong? And maybe you're thinking, well, I am, but I'm supposed to say that I'm not. So do you blame God when things go wrong? And you're probably thinking, well, I do, but I'm not supposed to, right? Because that isn't very Christian. I want to encourage you, actually, even in the Bible, people who love God get upset with God. It's not an unchristian thing to pour out your heart to God. In fact, Job does it, and he does it. We're looking at chapter 28, but if you look at chapter 27, it's a very different kind of chapter, and he complains. He says, verse 2, as God lives, who's taken away my right, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter. He's kind of cross with God. God, you've made my life miserable. And he says so. And maybe you're a bit shocked to discover that in the Bible by a guy that we know is God's friend. We see the same thing in the Psalms. We're looking at some of the Psalms on our weekend away, the songbook of the Bible. Some of the Psalms are very upset with God. God, why? They say. You may know the book of Habakkuk, one of the prophets. It's centered around two complaints that Habakkuk makes to God. So it's not an unchristian thing to do that, I think. It's an unchristian thing to badmouth God to other people, but to come to God himself in prayer and say, God, I do not understand, and I'm upset. This doesn't make sense. Why? There's lots of examples in the Bible of godly people doing that. In fact, even Jesus does that as he's on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus knows the answer to it, but it's okay to voice the question when you're suffering. It's not an unchristian thing. But in chapter 28, it's a bit of an exception in the book of Job. So most of Job is Job trying to make sense of his suffering and not making any sense of it. He's confused. He's upset. His friends are no help. He argues with them back and forth. And chapter 27, he's very upset. And in chapter 29, he's very upset. But then in chapter 28, it's like he suddenly has a glimpse of realization and things make a little bit more sense just for a chapter before he then goes back into confusion. And so we're going to look at that chapter together. And I think it's really going to help us to know what to do when we suffer if we're Christians. Now, it might be you're here and you're not a Christian and you're really welcome. We call Grace Church Greenwich a church for skeptics, inquirers and believers, and I think that's probably everyone between the three of them. So whoever you are, you know, if you're here just looking into Christian faith, you're here and you're pretty skeptical about the Christian faith, you're super welcome. And if you're a believer in Jesus, you're super welcome. This is a Christian answer to what we do when we don't understand. And Job starts off in chapter 28 by telling us that human beings, we're quite good at finding things out. And he takes as an example of this, mining. Now, I don't know if you thought much about mining. I mean, probably not your thing. And, you know, most of us, if we do have gold jewelry or whatever, you know, somebody else dug it and we didn't even think about it. It happened so long ago, we just got it from a jeweler's shop. But in the ancient world, if you got some gold, it's because somebody dug it up from a hole in the ground. Actually, it happens to us as well, but somebody else did it for us. But actually, when you think about it, and we're going to think about it for a bit, mining is actually pretty impressive. And bear with me, you're thinking, what has this got to do with when I suffer? But this is where Job starts. Human beings are pretty good at mining. Verse 28, verse 1. Surely there is a mine for silver. There's a place for gold that they refine. Iron is taken out of the earth. Copper is smelted from its ore. Man puts an end to darkness. He searches out the farthest limit, the ore in gloom and deep darkness. And Job thinks this is quite impressive. And if you've done the history of the human race and civilization, you'll know that those were some of the big marker posts, weren't they? When we got to the Bronze Age and we worked out how to make bronze out of rocks, worked out how to smelt copper. That was a big step forward for civilization. And then a bit further on, we worked out how to do it with iron. And Job's looking back on the same history and saying, that's pretty impressive. And actually, we've got better and better at it. This is kind of irrelevant, but I just love the picture. I looked up mining today, biggest mining truck in the world. And there it is. It's the number 75710. If you ever meet a miner, you can show off your knowledge of them. And it's really quite big. And this is just exactly how big it is. I guess they're quite short people, aren't they? But even so, that is a big wheel. So we're pretty good at it. And our whole society is built on it. And it is a testimony to human advances I know you're looking at the picture, so. It's a testimony to human advances in technology. In opening up, Job says, the valley far away from anyone else, underneath it. And we can overturn the mountains, verse 9. That's impressive. And in fact, Job, because he's got a Christian view of the world, he says, actually, not only is this impressive, but it's unique amongst all the creatures of the earth. Because humans can do this, and animals can't. And if you think about it, I mean, my dog, he does dig holes, but he can't mine iron, right? So, I mean, animals just aren't very good at mining, and humans are. And again, it's kind of obvious to think about it. But Job thinks this is worth saying. Verse 7, that path, so deep beneath the earth where they mine gold, and that path, birds of prey don't know it. Falcon's eye has not seen it. You know how eagles can, people work out sort of what the equivalent camera lens would be for an eagle, and they can see, like they can read newspaper about half a mile away or something crazy. So eagles are really good at seeing stuff, much better than we are, but they can't mine, like obviously. And lions can't do it, verse 8. I mean, obviously. But you think about it, eagles and lions, they're pretty impressive. You know, they can soar high above, they can be the king of the jungle and so on, but they can't do this. And that is a Christian view of the world, right? That human beings are above the animals. We're more advanced than any other animal. We've got a lot further than any other animal. We can search out many things, but we can't search out wisdom. And I almost don't need to say this first bit of the sermon because Fiona illustrated it so brilliantly. You know, we can find gold stars that someone tied a bit too strongly to the pillar. Sorry about that. That was me at the back. We can find sweets, though I think there are still some sweets that adults might want to find just hidden on those railings over there. There's lots of things that we can find, but wisdom, it is beyond us. Verse 12. Yeah, sure, big mining trucks, but where shall wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? And then the next paragraph, it just tells you that wisdom is really, really valuable, and yet it's really hard to find. And I guess those two things combined, they're sort of tantalizing for the miner, aren't they? Because people go to quite a lot of effort to find things that are worth a lot of money. So I used to live with a seismologist. He's probably not a very eco-friendly job. But basically, he used to detonate massive explosions on the bottom of the ocean and then measure the reflections of the vibration wave. And then he'd do that and he'd plot out the rocks underneath the ocean in case there was some oil. And he had this map showing that he did it off the Faroe Islands and all the places where oil was meant to be. I caused a major crisis one evening because I invited a friend who worked for BP round for dinner without realising that she worked for BP. And there's all these sort of maps strewn everywhere. Apparently the information on these maps, if they had been looked at by somebody who understood seismology, would be, you know, worth hundreds of thousands of pounds of oil. Anyway, but people go to a lot of effort to find oil because it's very valuable. And diamonds, you know, diamond mines, you'll go a long way to find a diamond. The more it's worth, the harder you'll try. And it turns out wisdom is the most valuable thing of all. But tantalizingly, you can't find it. You can't even buy it with things that you can find. So you mine gold, but you can't exchange it, verse 15, for gold. You find precious pearls, but you can't pay for it with pearls, verse 18. Wisdom is valuable, but it's beyond us. And we discover, as we discovered in the kids' talk, that God is the only one who knows where it is. Verse 23, God understands the way to it. He knows its place. He looks to the ends of the earth. He sees everything under the heavens. So, you know, eagles can read newspaper prints at half a mile away. But God can read everything. He can see everything. And no wonder, because God made everything. Like, of course God knows the position of every atom in the universe, because he put it there. Verse 25, when he gave to the wind its weight, when he apportioned the waters by measure, when he made a decree for the rain and made a way for the lightning and the thunder. You know, weather is in a way even harder than mining, apparently. Like, if you talk to scientists, you kind of get a hierarchy of which science is most impressive. You know, you put in a room a miner with one of those trucks and a weatherman. The weatherman's got quite a good case that his science is even harder. Because you probably know, or maybe you know, that the biggest supercomputers in the whole world are used to try and guess the weather, because it's so complicated. And they try and work out what the temperatures are in every bit of the ocean, and then basically guess what the weather will be like next week. And even then they get it kind of largely wrong. But not only is God good at mining because he put the gold there, but God's good at the weather because he put that there. God knows everything. He's a lot further on than we are. And he's the only one who knows where wisdom is. I just want to stop and pause on this. I've just said three things. They're pretty simple things, but they're very profound. Human beings are good at finding things out, much better than any other animal is. We've got a unique place in the creation. But there's some things that we can't find out. And ultimate wisdom is beyond us. But God, he can find it out. Because after all, he made the universe. Now, those are very simple things, but they are very profound. And they tell us God knows more than we do. I mean, that should be obvious, isn't it? But God is not on a level with us. He understands things that we do not understand. Theologians call it the doctrine of the incomprehensibility of God. And when you say God's incomprehensible, it doesn't mean that, you know, God doesn't make any sense, you can't understand him. It just means God is beyond you. The English word comprehend, it means to sort of fit something in, to go all the way around it. And you can't fit God into your brain. You can't get the whole of him in your understanding. He's beyond you. He knows more than we do. And that is really, really important to grasp. In particular, it's important to grasp in the middle of a book like Job. When you suffer, often our reasoning goes like this. If I can't understand why, then there can't be a reason why. If it doesn't make sense to me, then it doesn't make sense. But what we should say is, well, it doesn't make sense to me, but after all, I'm pretty limited. I'm pretty small. I presume it probably makes sense to God, and he's a lot bigger than me. And that's okay. I mean, it's kind of obvious, isn't it? Let's try it. He's been comparing us with eagles and lions. I'll compare us with some slime mold and a cocker spaniel. Cocker spaniel, obviously, because I've got one, as you know. So slime mold doesn't understand the command to sit. You can get some, I mean, probably you haven't got much slime mold, hopefully, in your house, but if you leave some bread for long enough, you'll get some slime mold. And you can try telling it, sit, and the mold will not change. Right? Slime mold doesn't get commands, obviously. Cocker spaniels kind of sometimes understand the command to sit. So, you know, you've got a 50-50 chance. More chance if you're holding some food, which Gustav knows will be an immediate reward for obeying you. But Gustav, he understands the command to sit. He doesn't really understand quantum mechanics. I understand the command to sit, and I kind of understand 50-50 quantum mechanics, as I did when I studied at a university years ago. But I don't always understand suffering. And like, that's okay. Because just as Gustav, the Cocker Spaniel, understands more than the slime mold, and I understand a bit more than Gustav, I'm not like the ultimate understander of the universe. You know, there's a hierarchy. Eagles, they can't do mining. Humans can do mining, but we can't do wisdom. We haven't reached the top yet. God knows more than we do. And it's just possible that he understands things that we don't understand. Now, the reason this is really relevant is because, I don't know if you can read this, this is a photo taken by one of our captains, one of the kids at Grace Church, of her RE school classroom wall this week. And I didn't ask her to take it, but she took it and shared it with her dad. He shared it with me. And it's kind of, you know, this is what kids in the UK are taught in RE. So it's quite shocking. So on the left, either God can do nothing to stop catastrophes, or he doesn't care to, or he doesn't exist. God is either impotent, evil, or imaginary. Take your pick and choose wisely. And I think that's Sam Harris. Even though it's a blur, but I think that's by Sam Harris. Or on the right, the difficulty is old, but nonetheless real. An omnipotent being who created a world containing evil, not due to sin, must himself be at least partially evil. No one can believe in a good God if they sat at the bedside of a dying child. Now, these kind of quotes, I guess, are typical of atheists, angry atheists in our age and in a previous age. And they basically say, in a world of suffering, a good God cannot exist. And you might have heard that around you. Maybe you heard Stephen Fry saying the same thing loudly a few years ago. It's sort of everywhere. I wonder if you noticed, though, that there's a kind of claim in both of those to understand how things are in the world. They're very sort of confident statements of philosophers who think that they get it. The one on the left, I think, is really quite it's quite arrogant. You choose your verdict about God. He says, why don't you choose? And choose wisely. The implication, you are wise, and you're so wise that you can be God's judge, and you can see whether he's done the job correctly. And Bertrand Russell, similar. I mean, it's the horrible irony there, isn't it? No one can believe in a good God if they sat at the bedside of a dying child. I mean, it's an awful thing. And of course, Job knows that. He's knows seven dead children in his family. Awful thing. But of course, right at the heart of the Christian gospel is a dying child. The God who loved the world so much that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. Bertrand Russell is ignoring the center of the Christian message as he invites us to make our judgment about God as people who understand. And I think what's going on is something like this. I understand that a loving God would never allow suffering. And suffering exists. And so therefore, a loving God doesn't exist. That's what the atheist says. But let's just reverse it. A loving God does exist. Suffering does exist. So let's combine those two things and think we can get a different answer. Well, that shows me God must sometimes have reasons for allowing suffering that I do not understand. It's the atheist on the left, that's their logic, and it's the Christian on the right. And the Christian is saying about suffering, look, I just don't necessarily understand it, but that's not a surprise to me because I don't understand everything about the universe. Because I'm only a human being. I mean, you know, I understand a bit more than a dog, and I can mind things better than a lion. But there are limits. And these are mysteries that are too great for me. I don't get it all. Now, I don't know. I'm imagining if Sam Harris or Bertrand Russell were here, they'd say, well, that's a cop-out. You know, you're just saying, oh, it's a mystery. You know, God doesn't need to give you a reason because it's all a mystery. But actually, God doesn't need to give us a reason because he's God. Now, actually, it turns out in Job, there is a reason. There is a reason why he suffers. And if you were here at the beginning of the series in chapters 1 and 2, God told us the reason. But Job doesn't know the reason. And I think that's often the way we're suffering. It turns out with hindsight, maybe sometimes we get to work out why God did it. So, you know, for example, at the point that Jesus was being crucified, it looked like a disaster. You imagine Jesus' disciples watching the cross, Peter and James and John and Mary's and others, and thinking, what's going on? And then 3 days later, when Jesus is alive again, and it turns out he's died for the sins of the world, and it's, oh, yeah, obviously, we knew that. I mean, with hindsight, it's obvious. I mean, sometimes we get to find out. Sometimes we never get to find out. Job, he never knows the reason that we know why he's suffering from chapters 1 and 2. But he's kind of okay with that. That there's a kind of humility that doesn't always need to know everything. Because we realize that we're limited, we're small, there are things that are beyond us. Yeah, sure, we're human beings have made incredible advances in technology, but we do not understand the universe. We don't understand everything. Maybe you know the great revolution in human philosophy that came with Descartes. I only know the same quote that you know from Descartes. I think, therefore I am. It's actually a terrible backward step for society. Because what Descartes was saying is, I'm going to ground everything in my own thinking. That's my starting point. I'm a thinking person, and I'll start there. And it's the wrong place to start. Like Gustav's view of the world being based on a cocker spaniel, or slime mold view of the world being based on a slime mold. I mean, you do better to say, look, I'm limited, and God knows more than I do. And I'm okay with that. And sometimes there are going to be questions I don't know the answer to, and that's okay. It's a call for humility. But then in our passage, God then tells us the essence of wisdom. So we don't know it. We can't find it. We can't mine it. But God does know it. And then he tells us. So here's the end of the passage. Let me read from verse 25. When he gave to the wind its weight, he apportioned the waters by measure. When he made a decree for the rain, when he made a way for the lightning of the thunder, then he saw, God saw, he declared it, he established it, he searched it, and he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding. Maybe you're disappointed, you're thinking, is that it? But it turns out that is the essence of wisdom that human beings can't find out. And let me just say a couple of things about that. Notice, the essence of wisdom is to know your place in God's universe, to fear him, to realize that you're smaller than him. And by that criterion, Sam Harris and Bertrand Russell are not very wise people. I mean, yeah, they're good at writing philosophical books and sounding clever, but they're actually very foolish because they haven't even understood their place in the universe. That's the beginning of wisdom, to know that God is God and we're not. The fear of the Lord is wisdom. And then to turn away from evil is understanding. In other words, wisdom isn't just about being clever. It's a moral thing. It's about doing what's right and walking in the right way. In Bond films, and I don't know about you, but I'm very excited about the next one. Comes out at the beginning of October, I think. There's a great so a friend of mine posted on Facebook a picture of the cinema outside his house, of the Everyman cinema, and the slogan said, "We've been expecting you, Mr. Bond." So I thought it was a clever way of announcing the new film. But in Bond films, you can have an evil genius, you know, usually with a cat and a swivel chair. But you can't have an evil genius in biblical thinking, because to be wise is not to be evil. It's a contradiction in terms. You can only be a good, godly, walking with God, wise person. Wisdom is moral. It's not about your IQ. It's about whether you live rightly or stupidly, whether you live in a way that is righteous or wicked, and whether it's a way that honours God or not. And that is a secret that a lot of philosophers don't know. But what I've been trying to do, I mean, I've got sort of two halves of sermon so far, right? So point one was, or the first half of it, point one to three was, God knows things that you don't know. And then the second half of it is, fear God and turn from evil, that's wisdom. Let's just try and put the two together, because they come in the same chapter, the same argument. God knows things you don't know, and God knows that wisdom is to fear him and turn from evil. And you don't know that. You need him to tell you that. And I've just been reflecting on that. This is my point five. It's putting everything together. We need God's help to live this way, especially when we suffer. So when you're in the middle of suffering and you're trying to understand it and you're wrestling with it, does it occur to you to think, I know the answer. The answer is to fear God and turn from evil. I don't think that is the first thought that occurs to you. I don't even think that's very satisfying to you. You think, I want answers. And what I really want Job to be told why it's all happening. And he never finds out in the whole book. But he doesn't need to know everything. We don't need to know everything. He just needs to know how to put one foot in front of the other to get safely through. And this is the way. You just got to trust God. And you've got to keep repenting. And probably that is not the answer that we will arrive at. You won't arrive at it, certainly, if you read Bertrand Russell or Sam Harris, one of these philosophers. You probably won't arrive at it if you search deep within yourself while you're suffering. You're just going to need God to show you. You're needing God to open your heart, to be content with God's God and I'm down here. And he knows more than I do, and that's fine. And to keep turning from evil, to keep repenting. We discover, of course, about Job, that Job is a wise man. If you remember, some of you weren't here at the beginning of the series, but when we began Job, we read verse 1 of chapter 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright. He feared God and turned from evil. And then God gave his verdict on Job in chapter 1, verse 8. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered Job? There's no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns from evil. And then the argument with Satan continues. And in chapter 2, verse 2, God says, chapter 2, verse 3, have you looked at Job? There's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns from evil. And we realize that is the very definition of a wise man. But chapter 28 tells us Job didn't get there by himself. No one arrives here by themselves. They arrive here because God knows this answer, and he tells it. He opens our heart to receive it. In the book of Acts, when the gospel is traveling, people are hearing the news that Jesus is Lord and King. People don't understand it by themselves. We discover in 1 Corinthians, they understand it only by the Spirit of Jesus, enabling them to understand the wisdom of the cross. I mean, in the book of Acts, people don't turn from evil by themselves. We discover in Acts that God grants them repentance. God gives them the ability to turn from evil. You see, when we're suffering, we're stuck. And we're too small to understand it. And we need to say, look, God, I don't get it. You get it. And I'm smaller than you, and I don't. Please help me. And the help that God gives the Christian when they're suffering day by day is to keep fearing him and to keep living for him. And to keep turning from evil. Sometimes we get to find out why it all happens. Not always. But that's what we need to get us through. I can think of Christians, and I'm not going to name them because they're sort of personal stories, but I can think of Christians in this church who suffered in all sorts of ways, that are suffering at the moment, some of them in ways. Some of you know about people who are having a very difficult time. And they don't understand why, but by God's grace, they keep remembering that we're small and God is big. And we've got to keep repenting and trusting him day by day. And they do, and they get through. And that's what we need to get through. I've got a coffee question. I think we're not actually serving coffee yet, but this is from the days when we did, and we will again soon. we're sort of gearing up again after lockdown. There'll be hot drinks when it gets a bit colder. But imagine a coffee question, or maybe when you go home and you make a coffee. But just to talk about, to think about, how has this chapter helped you? Not just a sermon to understand a sermon, but how is it going to help you practically when you suffer? What are you going to do with this chapter to help you in your suffering? We're going to take a pause, and then we're going to pray together.